Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Edward Girardet. He's journalist, author, and producer. He's founding director of the Institute for Media and Global Governance in Geneva. And his newest book is Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through Three Decades of War in Afghanistan. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me, and a great name for a radio program.
We are actually in a cafe. So your reporting covers three decades in Afghanistan, starting just before the Soviet invasion of 1979. But I think it would be fruitful to start a bit before that. Tell us what Afghanistan was like in the early 1970s. The society had been undergoing some transformation at that point.
Yes. Afghanistan during the 60s and early 70s was actually changing a great deal. You had two main donor countries involved. One was the Soviet Union, and the other was the United States. So a lot of Afghans, they either went for their education to the Soviet Union or to the East European East Bloc countries like Czechoslovakia, and others went to the U.S. And also quite a few went to Europe, particularly the lawyers, the philosophers, and so on. So it was becoming urbanized. Kabul itself as a city was becoming more and more like Istanbul or Tehran. You know, you had women who could wear miniskirts, men would sit around in cafes. They were becoming much more educated, but they were still a very small elite, in a sense, but a growing one. More people were getting educated. And what this also enabled was that you had different media emerging, different magazines. And with the emergence of these magazines, a lot of them were poetry magazines, for example. Afghans adore poetry and still do. But also, a bit like, 18th, 19th century Europe, the magazines became political parties. So you have the Hulk, which was the People's Party, named after a magazine called the Hulk, which was a communist one. Another was the Parchum, which meant banner or flag, which is another communist faction, more intellectual than the Hulk, and these became the communist parties. So there was a lot of change wrought by these different groups, and in 1978, the spring of 1978, the communist factions took power. They immediately began radicalizing Afghanistan by trying to push through very rapid reforms, some of which, would make sense to most Westerners, such as schools for girls, getting women to not to wear the veil, the purdah or the burqa. But this didn't go down too well because Afghan is a very heavily conservative society and still is. And the only way you could really bring about change is by persuading people very slowly, and you have to show examples. But the communists were extremely ruthless in the way they did it. They would go into the countryside, rip off veils from women. They would send teachers into the schools, doctors as well. And again, highly traditional society. They did not want their women to be treated by male doctors. They did not want their girls to be educated. So, and also, the regime was throwing people into jail, killing people, beating up people. So very rapidly, from the summer of 1978 onwards, a whole rebellion began to rise up, mainly in the countryside, but then also increasingly amongst intellectuals or moderates in the city, in Kabul and other cities, who began to resist and fight back against the communists, who were being quite repressive against them.
You write about the vast diversity of people in Afghanistan and that no one part of that country is representative of the whole. Why is this, and what does that say about Afghan unity or disunity on a political level?
Well, one of the first things I learned as a journalist was that when I went inside Afghanistan, particularly early on, I thought that when I visited with one particular group, such as the Baluch tribesmen in the south, that this is what Afghanistan was like. But very quickly, I became aware that, in fact, every area is different. And sometimes what you're seeing in one valley or one district is totally different elsewhere. So you could not speak as Afghanistan being a country in the sense, in a sort of Western sense. It's very diverse. So I then made the attempt to try and cover as many different parts as possible, going with different people to try and talk to the Tajiks, the Pashtuns, the Hazaras, the Uzbeks. I mean, the Hazaras, for example, are a Shia minority in central Afghanistan. They're Mongolian featured, and many believe that they were the remnants of Genghis Khan's fighters in Afghanistan. The Tajiks are more of a Mediterranean type people. It's a culture as opposed to an ethnic group. The Uzbeks are, again, they're also Mongolian featured from the north. The Pashtuns are very Semitic in their looks, very tribal people, very conservative, and lots of different subclans. So you have this incredible diversity in Afghanistan. But what was interesting that with the Soviet war, when the Soviets invaded in December 1979, it was the war which actually began to create a new sense of nationhood, because you had an expression, Watandar, which means countrymen. But in the beginning, the word Watandar was only used to describe someone from your village or from your valley. But by the mid-1980s, you'd be walking in the countryside, you'd be walking in the mountains or in the deserts, and you'd come across another group of guerrillas, Afghan guerrillas known as Mujahideen, and then the group you were with would say hello to them by saying, Watandar, they'd call them, meaning countrymen, how are you? And it became, it began to mean an Afghan, a fellow Afghan. So the Soviet war actually created a sense of nationhood, probably really for the first time.
In order for you to do the reporting you did, you learned to fit in, you learned Afghan customs to become friendly with people. Give us some examples of this.
Well, most of my reporting during the 1980s was done by foot. I had to cross clandestinely into Afghanistan, go from Pakistan over the mountains into Afghanistan. I travel with different groups. I'd also very often travel with the French, what were known as the French doctors. These were the French humanitarian medical teams who would go inside Afghanistan, sometimes for 6 to 12 months, and provide medical relief to the civilian populations inside the country. But for me, as a journalist, this was a brilliant way, actually, of seeing a different aspect of the country, because we would stop in villages, the doctors and nurses would set up clinics, for a day. I could also talk to or find out what the women were thinking, because most of these doctors were French women, and they had an access to a culture which I didn't have as a male, as a man. And so that gave me a different perspective. Also, the fact that you would walk 12, 14, 16 hours a day, walking through the countryside, through fields, through deserts. You'd arrive in a village at night. The villagers would give you a place to sleep. It could be the mosque. It could be someone's house. And then, of course, no matter how exhausted you were, the village elders would come, and they'd sit down and drink tea with you. And you could ask your questions, but then they had their questions, because despite the fact that probably 90% of the country was illiterate, it's actually probably 70% now, but in many areas the rural areas is like 90%. They still listened every day to the BBC World Service in Pashto and Dari, to the Voice of America, to Radio Tehran, to Radio Moscow. So they were actually quite well informed. So you would be able to have these long conversations about what the war was doing to their country, what was happening, and you drank, a hell of a lot of tea.
And one of the things I loved about this book is that we're really on the ground with you. We're trekking with you and getting tired with you and with your journalistic colleagues. And I can't remember the last time I drunk so much tea just by reading.
The tea drinking is crucial. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I was really amazed, as I think maybe you were too, by the extraordinary grace and kindness and curiosity that this most simple villagers had, and the courtesy with which they treated you.
Yes, I think that's what really, really struck me. And, you know, you have to remember that in the 1980s, the Soviet war, was creating the world's largest refugee problem. I mean, over 5 million Afghans fled. 3 million eventually fled to Pakistan. I wasn't able to go to the Iranian side as a journalist, but I certainly knew the Pakistan side very well. And you would meet people, and I'll give you one example, which I'd always remembered, and I was actually telling my own kids about this, because I wanted them to understand that, you know, we're living in the West and we're pretty privileged when it comes to not being in a war situation. And I was with my friend Peter Juvenal, the British photographer, cameraman, and we were heading back to Pakistan. We were exhausted, but we were also traveling with hundreds of refugees, and we'd stop for the night, and all the refugees and ourselves, we all made fires and sat there. And Peter and I had no food, and we sort of resigned ourselves to the fact that we wouldn't be able to eat or drink anything probably for the next 2 days until we got back to Pakistan. And I was sort of sitting there, you know, listening to the BBC on the radio, because I always had my transistor radio with me. And I was thinking to myself, oh, you know, what I would give for a cup of hot tea. And suddenly this very old man came walking up to us with a tray. I remember it was this silver tray with two cups of steaming tea and sugar. And sugar was an enormous, incredible luxury. And he gave it to us. Of course, we had to pretend that we didn't want it, you know, but he insisted. And then he said, you know, we know that you're a journalist, and we know that you don't have to come to our country to report what you're seeing, but we appreciate this. And, you know, we really want you to go back and tell the world the story about what is happening in Afghanistan. So we drank this tea, and I just felt, you know, these people had absolutely nothing, and yet they retained this extraordinary sense of dignity and hospitality. And I kept coming across this again and again and again. And I would often tell people, I'd say, you know, Afghans for me are incredibly civilized people, because even the poorest Afghan will sit you down in his house, maybe on a carpet, if he's got a carpet, and give you tea and maybe some biscuits or maybe some almonds. But it was all done in such a refined manner, in such a wonderfully civilized manner, that, you know, they had a dignity which you don't see very often elsewhere.
We're talking to Edward Girardet about his book, Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through 3 Decades of War in Afghanistan. Now, the Soviet Union was not the first power that tried to take over Afghanistan, and obviously not the last. Why does everyone want to control this country, and why is it so hard to control?
Well, Afghanistan has really never been colonized in the sense of the, you know, the 18th, 19th century. The British tried to go into Afghanistan 3 times, had 3 wars in Afghanistan, 2 in the 19th century, 1 in the early 20th century. The first war, the 1841-42 war, Anglo-Afghan war, was a complete disaster, where the British Expeditionary Force was annihilated. And these were 4,500 soldiers with camp followers. I mean, almost 16,000 people were killed by the Afghan tribesmen. The British wanted a buffer state which they could control between British India and the Tsarist Russian Empire. They also wanted to dictate to the Afghans what should be done. And by the time they'd finished their third war, they basically, what they had won was a new border known as the Durand Line, which is not recognized, by the way, today by the Afghan government, and which demarcates Pakistan with Afghanistan. And they basically recognized they could only control the foreign policy of Afghanistan, but not Afghanistan itself. When the Soviets went in, they went in for a variety of reasons. One, they did not want to have a new Islamic State on their border. Don't forget, Iran had just been taken over by Ayatollah Khomeini, and the Soviets certainly did not want to have a second Islamic State on their border. Also, for a long time under the Tsarist Russians, a policy assumed by the Soviets, wanted to have access to a warm water port in the Indian Ocean. So Afghanistan was one step in this direction. And also they were propping up a communist regime, which they didn't want to see collapse. And so there were a variety of reasons. Also, one which we're just coming to terms with now are the natural resources of Afghanistan. Afghanistan has now the world's largest copper mine. and may also have a lot of natural gas. I mean, there is natural gas, we know that, but it may also have oil. So there were a lot of unexploited resources which are now just coming to the fore. And probably finally, Afghanistan does control, it is the crossroads between the Indian subcontinent, the Middle East, Central Asia, and Europe. Because when you stand on the border of Afghanistan in Herat, the western border, with Iran, you can look across, and I remember doing this not too long ago, and thinking, I could actually drive to Europe in 3 days' time. I mean, it would be a hell of a drive, but I could actually do it. So you realize that, Europe is really not that far away. And, there is talk of building railroads through Afghanistan, gas pipelines. So as a crossroads, it remains crucial.
And, I mean, the other part of the question, why is it so hard to control? I mean, why is it so hard for anybody to ever win a military victory there?
Well, even the Afghans themselves can't win over each other. So if they can't do it, I'm sure no one else can. The problem is, even today, when you look at the Taliban and the other insurgents, I mean, the term Taliban is almost an absurd notion nowadays because there's so many different groups involved, and to call them Taliban, they're not all Taliban. Some are part of the Haqqani network, some are part of Hezbi Islami. But it's this disparate aspect of Afghanistan, the fact that there is no overall leadership, which makes it very, very difficult for any outsider to control or for Afghans themselves to control. So and the Soviets found this. They they tried to destroy the Afghan resistance, but there were so many different commanders of the interior. Some who worked together, others didn't. So you could win against one particular commander, but then you had to start all over again with another. So the Americans and NATO forces in Afghanistan today are finding exactly the same thing. And not just that, but you can't trust, and the Soviets were never able to trust the Afghan army or police because there were a lot of people who were sympathetic to the Afghan resistance and were actually asked by the Afghan resistance to remain in their positions of authority in order to have access to intelligence. The same thing's happening with the Afghan government today. I mean, Hezbi Islami, headed by Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who's a rather nasty insurgent politician who we actually, the U.S., supported massively during the 1980s alongside the Pakistanis. I mean, we created this monster, if you like. He's now one of the principal insurgent figures against the government, the Kabul government, and the NATO forces. But they have infiltrated the Afghan administration to an unbelievable extent. Also, a lot of the soldiers, a lot of the police, a lot of people supporting the government are also sympathetic to the opposition. I mean, but that's an Afghan trait. That's the way they survive because they know that the Americans and NATO forces will not remain forever. They have to accommodate to whoever else is going to stay behind. So if they had 5 feet, they would have 5 feet in five different camps. It's a survival technique.
Let's talk about this fellow Hekmatyar and also this other resistance leader, Massoud. You got to know both of them well. Who were these two men, and why did the U.S. choose to support one and not the other?
Well, that's a very good question, because Ahmad Shah Massoud was a northerner, an extraordinary individual, very charismatic. The French loved him because he was the first one to actually bring in the French doctors. He spoke French because he, not too good French, but it was good enough. He'd gone to the French Lycée, the French high school in Kabul. He is probably, or was probably, one of the greatest guerrilla strategists of the 20th century, alongside General Giap of Northern Vietnam, of Tito in Yugoslavia, and Ahmad Shah Massoud. He managed to stave off numerous Soviet offensives. He was known as the Lion of Panjshir because he was such a well-organized guerrilla commander. He was very interested in what was going on elsewhere in the world at the time. I mean, I met him for the first time in 1981 when a friend of mine, a French journalist, said, look, there's this Afghan commander up in the Panjshir Valley. He's really emerging as an incredible leader, and you should go see him. So I went up to see Massoud, and we met for the first time, and I got to know him quite well during the 1980s and into the 90s. But because he was a Tajik, because he didn't speak English, I think that was also one of the reasons, and because he was very independent-minded, the Pakistanis, the ISI, which is the military intelligence organization, which basically gave the direction of how the war should be fought against the Soviets to the United States, most of the American aid that came in through the CIA went through the ISI, through the Pakistanis, to the favorites of the Pakistanis. So we ended up supporting politicians or resistance leaders such as Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who's a very hardline fundamentalist who hated Americans, and yet we gave him the bulk of American support. That's as to why was a fascinating question. But we ignored people like Massoud, this leading commander, and other commanders of the interior who were not controlled by the Pakistanis. They were very independent. They were nationalists. They were modernist. Another one was Abdul Haq, another key figure. The United States would not support him. In fact, Milt Bearden, who was the head of the CIA in Pakistan at the time, referred to him as Hollywood Huck because he basically was quite attractive to a lot of the journalists who went in. He was well organized. He spoke very good English and also had a sense of humor. And so these people were ignored by the CIA, and in preference, we supported these Islamic extremists, most of whom are now fighting American and NATO forces in Afghanistan today. So it was very curious, but there were some people within the State Department and within the CIA who were trying to advise Washington not to do this and saying, by doing so, we are creating monsters for the future, and this will come back to haunt us. And yet this advice was consistently ignored by Washington in the 1980s. And when the U.S. abandoned Afghanistan, once the Soviets had left, then all these people began to develop into new anti-American or Western insurgents.
The incompetence of the U.S. intelligence services that you describe in the book is really staggering. I mean, the idea that they were getting their intelligence from Pakistan instead of from their own informants. You describe, there's this moment where you describe going to the U.S. embassy in Pakistan during the Soviet war, and there was no one there who spoke any of the languages of any of the people who were fighting.
It was astounding because Massoud, and this is not 1981, Massoud had asked me, I spent about 6 weeks in the north with him, and as I was leaving, he asked if he could talk to me. So I went with a translator, and we sat beneath a mulberry tree and walnut trees. And he said, look, I don't know whether you're a journalist or CIA, but we would like to have contact with the Americans. So I said, well, I am indeed a journalist, and it's not my job to put people, support clandestine movements, but I'll be more than delighted to put you in touch with the right people, and you take it from there. So he gave one of his commanders, who ran all the caravans, the horse caravans into Afghanistan, who actually was the one also responsible for the French doctors and the journalists, the foreign journalists. He came back with us, and I rang the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad, and I said, look, this is really beyond my remit, but this Afghan would like to meet you. And after a number of phone calls, they sent some guy to see us. And we met in what they would describe as a safe house in Islamabad. And this guy showed absolutely no interest whatsoever in the Afghan. He kept wanting to talk to us, myself and the filmmakers I was working with. And we kept saying, look, we're the journalists. This is your man. And there was no Russian speaker, and there was no Farsi or Dari speaker, which was astounding given that you had 100 miles away was one of the world's great superpowers with the Red Army involved in a war in Afghanistan.
We're talking to Edward Girardet, author of the book Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through 3 Decades of War in Afghanistan. Now, Afghanistan has been compared to Vietnam in both the case of the Soviet and the U.S. wars there. And I was really surprised, I mean, I guess not surprised, but I didn't really understand that the U.S. response when the Soviet Union went into Afghanistan was, oh, let them have their Vietnam. And then we didn't learn the lesson after that.
Absolutely. I mean, that was very much the what dictated the policy. It was Brzezinski who initiated that. And so the whole obsession with Afghanistan was based on how can we make it as bad as possible for the Soviets, and really sock it to them. But the result is that in post 9/11, when the U.S. and other coalition countries got involved in Afghanistan, we are now facing, in many respects, a new Vietnam. Because I from what I've seen, and I think anyone who works on the ground there, whether aid worker or journalist, and who actually knows Afghans, will say the same thing. It is a completely pointless war, achieving absolutely nothing. And, we missed one opportunity after another, and we're doing the same mistakes that the Soviets had done. You know, we imposed our own people. And, you know, one example of this, we imposed an American ambassador in 2002, Khalizad, Zalmay Khalizad, who was an Afghan-American. And, you know, anyone who knew Afghanistan at the time would have said, whatever you do, don't impose an Afghan national as your, or an American of Afghan origin, as your ambassador, because every Afghan knows this guy's baggage. They know who he's going to support. And the figure they should have probably supported was the former king, who represented a period of peace during the 1970s, a nostalgic period of peace. He was no great king, and in fact, he was probably a lousy king. But the fact is, in the eyes of most Afghans, that's what he represented. And he didn't have much time left. He had a couple of years left to live. And yet, the American ambassador imposed warlords on Afghanistan, people who were totally discredited, who were, you know, who should be in front of the International Court of The Hague. These people were put into power. And for most Afghans, you know, particularly ordinary Afghans, they thought when the Americans came in, they thought, well, you know, finally the war is now going to end. And they very rapidly saw that it was not going to happen, that the same people were being put back into power. And the result is that, you know, a new war developed. And there are many reasons for that, and we can go into that. But the fact is that these mistakes were made, and we just have not learned, despite the fact that in 2002 there were enough people on the ground. I was in on these conversations with the Council of Foreign Relations, talking to people with experience in Afghanistan, aid workers, journalists, analysts, and so on. And the common message given to Washington, to the Bush administration, was whatever you do, don't rush it, don't get involved militarily, focus on realistic recovery in the countryside where 80% of the Afghans live, and don't throw massive amounts of money at Afghanistan. It doesn't need that, but use intelligent development and intelligent investment. And that just did not happen.
In fact, it was the exact opposite, which we can talk about in a minute. I want to backtrack a little bit to the end of the Soviet war, you know, pre 9/11, 2001. The U.S. essentially abandoned Afghanistan after the Soviet Union left. What happened in that really less than a decade before the beginning of U.S. involvement? Describe that whole rise of the Arab jihadi movement and that contrast that you described so beautifully in the book between these new outsiders and the Afghan people.
Yes, well, during the 1980s, just to step back a bit, the Arabs got also heavily involved. These were official Arabs like Saudis, the Saudi government, or various princes within the government, or linked to the royal family, if you like. And then you have the al-Qaeda types. Of course, al-Qaeda didn't really exist. We didn't know about al-Qaeda in those days. But there were a lot of jihadists, foreign legionnaires, who were coming to Afghanistan during the 80s, which included people like bin Laden. In fact, bin Laden went first there in 1980 as a humanitarian. He went there to help the refugees. He very soon changed this approach, began raising funds and providing weapons for the Islamic fundamentalists of the Afghan resistance. And then you began seeing, toward the mid and late 80s, this emergence of actual volunteers, jihadists, coming to Afghanistan to fight. But they came to fight their own war, their own jihad. Afghanistan was the only jihad going at the time in the world. But they were not really fighting it for the Afghans. In fact, they were quite derogatory toward the Afghans. They're very arrogant. They said, well, these Afghans are not good Muslims. And you don't tell an Afghan that he's not a good Muslim, because, you know, every form of Islam is interpreted differently in different parts of the world, and the Afghan tradition also of hospitality, of Islam. I mean, I slept in mosques. I would sit during prayer periods very quietly by myself as they prayed. You know, they accepted you. The foreign Islamists who came in did not do that. They wouldn't talk to you. They wouldn't shake your hand. They abused you verbally. I mean, as you walked by, they would. I mean, and they. There are some other incidents in the book which you could read about, which I guess I'm not allowed to talk about on the radio. But basically, they were extremely rude toward other foreigners in the country who they considered to be kafir, you know, non-believers. And the Afghans, when the Soviets left in the early 90s, the Afghans actually kicked out the Arabs because of this arrogance, because of this desire to try and take over everything. But what happened then, when the Americans pulled out, a new civil war developed. The Pakistanis were pushing like mad to put Hekmatyar Gulbuddin into power, forcing the Afghans also to fight a conventional war, because the Communist administration actually remained in power for another 3 years. They actually fought very well because their backs were up against the wall. And Massoud was in the north. He moved into Kabul when he realized that Hekmatyar was trying to take Kabul. And most of the Kabulis did not want to have Hekmatyar come in, because particularly the urban educated feared Hekmatyar a great deal. I mean, he was a very nasty piece of work. He murdered, you know, thousands of Afghans. His shelling probably killed as many, up to 50,000 people in 1993-94 in Kabul, and I was actually there in 1993. It then developed into this rather nasty civil war, which gave the cause to the rise of the Taliban, who came in on a platform of, we provide law and order and security. And the Taliban were actually welcomed by many Afghans who were simply tired of the war. They wanted peace, and the Taliban brought peace. But then when they took Kabul in September 1996, they also began to become repressive toward the other minorities, such as the Hazaras in the Central Highlands, the minority Shias, and toward the Tajiks and the Uzbeks. And then, you know, the same old thing began. A new civil war developed. And except the Taliban were massively supported by the Pakistanis, by the ISI, by the Saudis, by al-Qaeda, but it was a civil war. And by 2001, they had controlled about 80% of the country. But what was interesting in early 2001 is that a lot of the Taliban in eastern and southern Pashtuns were becoming rapidly disenchanted by the dominance of the Pakistanis and the dominance of the Arab, of the al-Qaeda types in Afghanistan. And a new alliance was being developed behind the scenes by Ahmad Shah Massoud, together with Abdul Haq, this highly influential former guerrilla commander, a Pashtun, very modernist. And they were trying to set up a new very broad-based anti-Talib alliance in early 2001. And they believed they could probably attract over half the Taliban to their side. And Massoud, in April 2001, was in Paris, his first trip ever to Europe. And he met secretly with the Americans, and he warned them. He said, first of all, al-Qaeda is planning a major operation against the West, probably in the United States. Secondly, whatever you do, don't intervene militarily in Afghanistan. We don't need any intervention. But what you should do is put pressure on the Pakistanis and the Saudis to halt their support for the Taliban. And if this support were halted, the Taliban would collapse very, very quickly. And the Taliban was, in fact, in the process of imploding. And this was the message which they were trying to put across to the Americans and to the British, the MI6, but it was being totally ignored. And it was really only probably 2 weeks before the events of 9/11 that Condoleezza Rice and the Bush administration began to realize that something was going on. But finally, you know, just to understand that the Taliban were a faction in a civil war. They were not a terrorist organization. They took support, like any Afghan group, from anyone who gave it. And I don't think they really had control over al-Qaeda, and probably no more than 20 or 30 of the senior echelons of the Taliban really had any idea what al-Qaeda was up to globally. And the other irony is that, the U.S. government was supporting the Taliban as well. Cheney, Vice President Cheney, made a grant of $43 million to the Taliban in the spring of 2001 in recognition of their supposed crackdown on opium poppy production in Afghanistan.
And the great irony is that they gave money to the Taliban, as you say, Dick Cheney, this huge amount of money. They completely ignored Massoud's warnings. And then 2 days before 9/11, Massoud was assassinated.
Yeah, he was assassinated by al-Qaeda. I was actually in northern Afghanistan trying to see Massoud, and I wrote about this in the book. I wanted to sit down with Massoud and really go over the past 25 or 20-odd years of war to try and understand why he, what made him tick as a commander. What, I wanted to talk about guerrilla strategy. I wanted to try to understand who this man really was, what made him persist in this, ongoing struggle. Because he was getting tired. That was for certain. And I'd gone up to see him. And, of course, he was assassinated by two al-Qaeda operatives posing as journalists. So I met them in northern Afghanistan. So I never actually got to see Massoud. I actually left a couple of days early because my wife's birthday was on September 13th, and I promised her that I would be back, and that probably saved my life because Massoud had a habit of always inviting any friends or journalists who were around at the time of an interview just to sit in on the interview, like some sort of, tea party. And, another type of tea party. And so this probably saved my life. But what al-Qaeda was doing, I think they were giving to the Taliban a present because Massoud was the last significant commander opposing the Talib forces, who had by then taken 80% of the country. But also, al-Qaeda was perfectly aware, I believe, that Taliban were in the process of imploding. And they realized that if they didn't get rid of this guy, Massoud, then the Taliban might well implode. And they would lose their protection in Afghanistan or their ability to maintain bases in Afghanistan.
We're talking to Edward Girardet about his book, Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through 3 Decades of War in Afghanistan. So then in 2001, 9/11 happened. U.S. began its intervention in Afghanistan in retaliation. What was your hope at that point? You talked a moment ago about missed opportunities. What was your hope for what could have happened at that moment had the U.S. made some good decisions?
Well, it was a very serious mistake, I think, to bomb. And, despite the fact that the emotions in the U.S. were extremely high and the anger because of 9/11, and people were looking for a revenge. But to take out revenge in that way was really not contributing to anything, because by bombing, they were basically creating a whole new slew of Afghan bin Ladens, if you like. Abdul Haq, who was killed by the Taliban, this is, again, this commander who was trying to put together this new alliance, anti-Talib alliance, he was repeatedly telling the CIA, and this is in September leading up to early October, he was repeatedly telling the CIA and MI6 in London not to bomb, but to give this new alliance a bit more time, and they would pull most of the Taliban, disenchanted Taliban, to their side, and there was no need for a war. This was completely and utterly ignored by the CIA, by Washington, and Washington wanted, in their words, fireworks. I mean, they were playing to the audience. And I remember I had written a piece at the time, warning that, it was not a good thing to bomb. They could have perhaps gone in with very well-informed sort of police-style or, special forces-type operations and really arrest, go in and take out or arrest, whatever expression you want to use, the elite of the Taliban and probably al-Qaeda, which they could have done. That intelligence was available, but they did not. They wanted to go and bomb massively, and the moment they bombed, they hardened the resistance of a lot of these Pashtun tribesmen who are highly conservative, who dislike any outsiders, and by bombing, we became the new outsiders involved in Afghanistan militarily, which was a huge mistake. And I think that mistake, that started the new war in Afghanistan. It didn't happen immediately, but it certainly set the basis for it. And, you know, the wonderful thing about writing a book now is I can say what I think. As a journalist, you're always holding back. But I really think that decision by the Bush administration is the reason why now almost as many American, British, German, Danish, you know, French troops have now died in Afghanistan as people died in the bombings, you know, the events of 9/11, and, you know, not even to talk about the almost 20,000 Afghans have also died.
You write then about the rebuilding or the attempted rebuilding of Afghanistan's infrastructure, of the city of Kabul, of the justice system, the police force, all of which were, as you describe it, pretty much a disaster. Again, people not listening to the advice of the people who live there, the people on the ground.
Yes, I mean, a lot of aid organizations have an enormous amount of experience in Afghanistan. These include people like the International Committee of the Red Cross, the Swedish Committee for Afghanistan, CARE International, which is based in Atlanta. I mean, CARE has been involved with Afghanistan for over 60 years, has a lot of experience, and almost all these organizations have always worked very closely with a small group of expatriates, meaning, you know, foreigners. I mean, the Swedish Committee, for example, at one point had 15,000 employees, most who were then seconded in 2003-04 to the various ministries of health, education, and that was the purpose of what they did. Today, the Swedish Committee has about 5,000 Afghan employees and only 8 foreigners, mainly in positions of, you know, directors or managers, accountants, who have to deal with the foreign donor countries. But the fact is they work with Afghans. They also do not have mercenaries or security armed contractors protecting them with weapons. That is the worst thing you can do. They rely on contacts with all members of the community. In fact, today, CARE, ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, the Swedish Committee, Madeira, which is a small French agricultural group which also worked in Afghanistan during the 80s, they all talk with everyone from NATO to the Afghan government to the Taliban to local communities. That is their best protection. You let everyone know what you're doing, why you're doing this. But this means drinking a lot of tea and can also mean months and months of negotiating with local communities. But that is, to my mind, the only way it will work. What the international community did, we came in with a lot of money. We brought in contractors. I'll give you one example. The road between Kabul and Kandahar, a crucial road, as a highway, was initially built by the Americans in the 60s. It was then supposed to be re-asphalted in order to make it useful for, you know, for the NATO forces, for the Afghan government. It was given out to, the contract was given to a private company who did not bother to talk with the local communities along the way. And I remember talking to this USAID engineer, American, and I said, you know, why haven't you talked with all the communities? And he said, well, we haven't got time for that. And I said, yes, but that, you know, that is the best way you're going to protect this road. And because they never bothered to talk with the local communities, sit down with them for tea, explain the reason behind the rebuilding of the road, hiring the local people to, with picks and shovels instead of bringing bulldozers, to get them to work in the road, and then to maintain the road later. That way they would provide both security and maintenance, and they would benefit the local communities by also enabling these very poor farmers to earn some cash so they can buy tea, sugar, and things like that. But they refused to do that. So the result is you have this beautifully asphalted road, which is useless because no one in the right mind is going to drive down this road because it's too dangerous, because the local communities are not providing the protection for or the security for it. So there are numerous examples of this, and we simply fail to understand that we should have gone in there slowly. There are no quick fixes in Afghanistan. You're looking at 20 to 30 years of slow development and investment. It's not just development. It's also giving the right investment. Afghans are entrepreneurs. They know how to deal with business. And this was simply not done. We wanted quick fixes. We wanted things to happen quickly. But we also ensured that, you know, the World Bank, the UN, all these big organizations that came in, we try to create Kabul in our own image. And this simply does not work. And what it has meant is that the countryside, where as many as, you know, 4/5 of the population live, they have simply not seen the benefits of recovery, of which they heard so much about, and all this money coming in, and they've just not seen any real results.
We also, by that kind of rushed development, created a class of slum dwellers that had never been there before. And
Absolutely. There
was incredible devastation of the countryside, and still is, of forests and wildlife and natural resources, which I found as painful as the whole rest of it, the whole human catastrophe, given how beautiful that country seems to be.
Mm-hmm. No, I visit, you know, what I found so sad is that, you know, even during the 1980s, I walked through staggeringly beautiful forests, you know, mountainous areas. I never realized Afghanistan was like that. In many ways, it's like Wyoming, you know, with the forests and mountains. And then I went back 4 or 5 years later. It was all gone. Everything had been cut down because no one was in control of the forest anymore. The communities did not own the forest. So the Pakistanis came in, or Afghan groups came in. They cut down the forest, the timber, they shipped it out, and was all gone. And then, you know, 22,000 villages during the 1980s were destroyed or badly devastated by the war. So when people came back, when the refugees began going back, they, you know, in a way they'd seen the bright lights because they'd been in refugee camps in Pakistan. Their kids had gone to school because under Pakistani law, they all had to go to school. And even these highly conservative areas in eastern Afghanistan today have girls' schools. And these were the very people who resented the communist repression of trying to impose schools before. On their own, they have set up schools. But the fact is that these Afghans, when they came back, they had to make a living, and they were given some support, you know, through the High Commissioner for Refugees of the UN, but really they had to go into the cities to look for jobs. So the result is now we have, and this is all envisaged, I mean, this could have been prevented by not focusing on small towns in the countryside to at least create local jobs or at least help, you know, resuscitate the countryside, and also to, you know, even pay villagers to reforest the hillsides. That would have been one way of very, very cheaply reforesting the country, and by giving a bit of trickle down of money, of cash, again to the countryside. I mean, there were so many different examples, and, you know, one I mentioned in the book of these commanders I'd met during the war. They, you know, we'd talked during the war, long nights drinking tea. I would say, or myself and other journalists would say, you know, you have an amazing country here. You could turn this into the most fantastic trekking area, ecotourism. You've got, you know, you have wood carpenters who are doing beautiful work. So they came down to see me in 2003, 2004 with projects. And they said, no one will talk to us. We want to do this. We want to set up ecotourism in Nuristan, which is in eastern Afghanistan. We want to do this, do that. The World Bank, the UN Development Program, they didn't really want to talk to these people. So I would organize these brown bag lunches in my house and invite everyone, and I'd have these Afghans give presentations. And I'd say, okay, now it's up to you guys, the big, you know, organizations, to help these people. I mean, you know, they don't know how to set up projects, but with help they could. But the result is no one did. And so there was, you know, people left the countryside. These wonderful carpenters would go into the cities like Jalalabad and Kabul and build very boring chairs, nothing special, whereas there was a plan to allow them to stay in their villages and to work as part of a sort of cooperative where you could have had outsiders helping them with quality control, make wooden toys, which would have been great for export. I mean, there were a lot of things which could have helped bring revenue into the countryside and just didn't happen.
The book is called Killing the Cranes. Tell us how the book got its name.
Well, very quickly, a friend of mine who was very seriously wounded in the assassination of Ahmad Shah Massoud, I'd gone to see him in Kabul in 2004, the spring of 2004, and we talked about the war had done, how traumatized people were, the responsibility of the international community and also of Afghans themselves. And after a very long, depressing conversation, we walked outside and we looked up in the sky. It was the end of March, and he said, you know, for me, the end of March was always the time when you couldn't hear the sound of your voice for the migrating cranes. And these were the Siberian cranes, which traditionally wintered in the wetlands of southern Afghanistan and Iran and Balochistan, and then in very early spring would migrate back to Siberia and Russia. And then he turned to me and said, you know, since being here, I haven't seen or heard a single crane. And then he said, have we even killed all the cranes?
And you end your book, I still hope to see the migrating cranes again one day.
Absolutely, because, I mean, you can't help but be attached to that country. And I think the return of wildlife is, I think, actually quite significant and crucial, signifying an end to war, but we have to wait for that.
Edward Girardet is author of the book Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through 3 Decades of War in Afghanistan. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.